So Mother Sritama was going to speak on her realizations with Srila Prabhupada and her first years in Krishna consciousness, but she is sick and her younger daughter didn't communicate it. So, but since it says Srila Prabhupada Katha, we can do some reading from Srila Prabhupada Lilamrita and take that as the part at least for today, and then Sritama Mataji, she can then speak at another occasion. Chapter 31, A Threat Against ISKCON, Boston, December 21, 1969. More than 100 of Srila Prabhupada's disciples and followers are in the lobby of the international terminal of Boston's Logan Airport. Kirtanandana Swami has come from New Vrindavan with a truckload of devotees. Not a busload, but a truckload. The devotees from New York are here with a large banner. New York ISKCON welcomes Srila Prabhupada. Most of the devotees wear heavy coats over their dhotis and saris and are chanting Hare Krishna. Some play drums and cymbals. A few babies and children are present. Waiting passengers can only watch, startled. So it's a special scene. Especially at that time. Prabhupada's plane is late and the devotees continue chanting, often leaping into the air with outstretched arms. They haven't seen Prabhupada in a long time and they are waiting, expecting to see him at any moment. Oblivious of the proprieties of being in public, the devotees chant emotionally, building almost to uncontrolled ecstasy. So the people must have been wondering what's happening here. When they see the devotees ecstatically chanting and dancing. The state police step in to tell the biggest devotee, Brahmananda, cool it. The chanting falls away to a murmur of japa. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. The plane from London arrives. The devotees are unable to see the passengers entering in the glassed-in immigration and customs area because the bottom 6 feet of the glass wall is painted black. Straining to see over the top, the devotees press forward, chanting, feverish, some almost hysterical. Suddenly they see Prabhupada's raised hand with big back on the other side of the wall. They can see only his raised hand and big back. They go wild. Fearlessly, with drums and cartels, the kirtan explodes again. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. Advaita is tearfully smashing the cartels together and chanting. Brahmananda jumping up and down, trying to glimpse into the customs room, is crying uncontrollably and yelling, Prabhupada, Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada, free of customs, suddenly appears before them. Kirtananda Swami, reserved until now, leaps around airport chairs and runs to him. Everyone is pushing and running, trying to be where Prabhupada is. Prabhupada's saffron robes are wrinkled from the long flight, and he wears a knit sweater. He holds his white plastic attaché case in his left hand, and again raises his hand, arm with forefinger and thumb extended from the beatback. He smiles wonderfully, beaming to his children. Devotees cheer and cry. All glories to Prabhupada. As he walks forward to the saffron-covered sofa in the airport lounge, the devotees move with him in an ecstatic wave, pressing in close. He sits down. Paramananda from New Vrindavan comes forward with his infant son, the first boy born in ISKCON, and holds him forward to Prabhupada for blessings. Prabhupada is smiling, and the devotees are completely, unabashedly blissful. Where is Hayagriva? Prabhupada asks. The question is repeated by the devotees, and big Hayagriva lurches through the crowd, grumbling and falling flat at Prabhupada's feet in obeisances. One by one, the leaders of the various ISKCON centers come forward and place garland after garland around Prabhupada. Prabhupada looks beyond the wall of devotees at the newsmen with their cameras and at the baffled, curious, and disdainful onlookers. A bystander says, "I think he must be some kind of politician." So, Prabhupada begins speaking, "The spiritual master is to be worshipped as God. But if he is thinking that he is God, then he is useless. My request is, please don't take Krishna consciousness as a sectarian religion." Prabhupada explains that Krishna consciousness is a great science, culminating in pure love of God. "These boys and girls have never heard of Krishna before," Prabhupada continues, "but now they have taken it up so naturally, because it is natural." Prabhupada says that he is an old man, yet he is sure that even if he passes away, his students will continue the Krishna consciousness movement. The potency of this movement is such that it can awaken awareness of God within anyone's heart. After the lecture, Prabhupada stands and is escorted outside, where a limousine waits to drive him off through the newly fallen snow. Riding joyfully in the car with Prabhupada were Kirtanandana Swami, Brahmananda, Satsvarup, and Purushottama. A professional chauffeur drove. Prabhupada talked of London. "It was an old aristocratic city," he said, "and the temple was in a very influential area near the British Museum. The location is what is called downtown, in the center of the city." They passed a large billboard advertising a restaurant and lounge, Continental. On seeing the billboard, Prabhupada said, "Chintamani, what is that?" "Oh no, Continental." The devotees looked at one another. "Chintamani?" Prabhupada had thought that the sign had read Chintamani, meaning the spiritual gems that make up the transcendental land of Krishna Loka. But Prabhupada himself was Chintamani, pure and innocent, coming to the cold, dirty city of Boston, yet always thinking of Krishna wherever he was. How fortunate to be with him. Satsvarup glanced at the professional chauffeur. "Drive carefully," he said. Prabhupada spoke softly from the back seat, while the devotees in front peered back, barely able to see him in the darkness, and completely awed by his friendly yet unconceivable presence. The other day, Srila Prabhupada said, I told George Harrison that if he thought his money belonged to him, that was Maya. At the Sumner Tunnel, the limousine pulled up at an automatic toll booth. The driver threw a coin into the chut, and the red light turned green. Prabhupada asked if sometimes people drove through without paying, and Brahmananda replied that an alarm would go off. They moved ahead into the Sumner Tunnel, usually an eerie, nerve-wracking place, but not when riding with Prabhupada. I told George to give his money to Krishna, Prabhupada said. Not that he had to give it to Krishna by giving it to me, necessarily, but that somehow or other he must spend all his money for Krishna. Brahmananda said, but you are the only way to Krishna. Prabhupada laughed lightly. Yes, he admitted, at least in the West. This was the great privilege of being able to ride with Prabhupada, to hear him say little things or serious things, and to see his fathomless expression or his kind smiling. It was a rare opportunity. Srila Prabhupada continued, I am representing unadulterated teachings. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, surrender to me. And I say, surrender to Krishna. It is very simple. So many Swamis come and present themselves as Krishna, and it is all spoiled. But I say, surrender to Krishna. I do not say anything new or adulterated. Krishna says, surrender to me. And I say, surrender to Krishna. Prabhupada asked Brahmananda if 50,000 copies of Back to Godhead magazine were being printed. Brahmananda answered that they were. Good, Prabhupada replied. Turning his attention to Satsvarup, Prabhupada asked how the composing machine was working. And Satsvarup said that hundreds of pages were being composed each month. Prabhupada asked Kirtanandana Swami about New Vrindavan. New Vrindavan would improve, Prabhupada said. The only thing wrong was that it got blocked up in the winter. Each devotee in the car felt completely satisfied by his brief exchange with Prabhupada. And they rode with him, intoxicated in spiritual bliss. Most of the devotees had raced ahead to the temple on Beacon Street and were waiting excitedly. The limousine pulled up, and again the devotees were unrestrained in their adoration of their spiritual master. Regally, Prabhupada walked up the walkway onto the porch steps, through the front door, and into the vestibule, where he gazed around at the purple walls and the pink and green doorways. Surrounded by cheers and loving looks, he smiled. The second floor parlor, now the temple room, was filled with more than 150 disciples and guests, and they could see Prabhupada from rise into view as he came up the stairs. He still carried his white attaché case in his left hand and his big bag in his right. And although he had just come out of the winter's night, he wore no coat, only cotton robes and a sweater, He appeared radiant. Prabhupada approached the altar. He seemed to notice everything. The small Radha Krishna deities enthroned beneath a red velvet canopy, the larger deities of Jagannath Subhadra and Balaram, and a raised shelf above the picture of Lord Caitanya and his Sankirtan party. Even the brass arti paraphernalia brightly shining on the small table near the altar. Turning to his secretary and traveling companion Purushottama, he asked, "What do you think, Purushottama? Isn't this very nice?" Crossing the room, Prabhupada sat on the red velvet Vyasasan. He spoke and the audience was attentive. After praising the London center, the deity worship there, the expertly made puris for Radha and Krishna, he turned toward the altar and said, "If you clean the deity's utensils, your heart will become cleansed." By polishing the deity's paraphernalia, he said, the devotees were cleaning their spiritual master's heart also. As he spoke, focusing simply and purely on devotion to the deity, the devotees suddenly realized the importance of these aspects of their Krishna consciousness. Prabhupada asked, "Who has made these clothes?" Glancing at Radha and Krishna's little flounced dresses. "Saradiya," a few devotees called out. Prabhupada smiled, "Thank you very much." Then he threw back his head and laughed. "Is Saradiya still fighting with her husband?" The devotees and guests laughed, while Saradiya covered her face with her hands. "Don't fight with your husband," Prabhupada said. "He is a good boy. Anybody that comes to Krishna consciousness is good." He then asked to see the rest of the house. 100 devotees straining to see and hear Prabhupada's responses followed him as he went downstairs. Although the crowd surrounded him, he remained relaxed and unhurried. He entered the press room, a long hall directly beneath the temple room. A large old offset press, a paper cutter, a folder and flats of paper stock filled the room, which smelled like a print shop. Advaita, the press manager, bowed down in his green khakis before Prabhupada. He rose up smiling and Prabhupada stepped forward and embraced him, putting his arm around Advaita's head. "Very good," he said. Standing before the printing press, Prabhupada folded his palms together and offered a prayer to his spiritual master. "Jai Om Vishnupad Paramhamsa Sri Srimad Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Goswami Maharaj Prabhupad Ki Jai." Advaita asked Prabhupada to give the press a transcendental name. Prabhupada said, "ISKCON Press." Matter-of-factly, as if it had already been named. "Keep all the machines very clean," Prabhupada said, "and they will last a long time. This is the heart of ISKCON." "You are the heart of ISKCON," Prabhupada, the devotee, said. And Prabhupada said, "And this is my heart," meaning the ISKCON press. Leaving the main press room, Prabhupada toured the other press facilities. Squeezing in, ducking under, standing on tiptoe, the crowd of devotees followed him step by step. He peeked into a little cubbyhole where a devotee was composing type. "The typesetters," he said, "should proceed very slowly at first, and in that way they would become expert." Turning to Advaita, he said, "Everyone in India who speaks Hindi has a Gita press publication. So everyone who speaks English should have an ISKCON press publication. Compared to most others, Prabhupada's literary contribution was already substantial. But he wasn't just an author. His mission was to flood the world with literature, glorifying Lord Krishna. Prabhupada's ISKCON was now 3 years old. Yet, his disciples were only beginning to execute his plans for printing and distributing transcendental literature. Printing was an important step, the first step. Months ago, Prabhupada had written," that's the quote of the letter he wrote, "the press must work on continuously and we shall produce immense volumes of literature. If the press goes on nicely, I shall be able to give you material for publishing a book every 2 months. We have got so much material for the Krishna consciousness movement." And just prior to coming to Boston, he had written Sankirtan and distributing back to Godhead and other literature is the fieldwork of this movement. Temple worship is secondary. Now ISKCON was printing 50,000 copies of Bhagavad Gita, back to Godhead per month. And Prabhupada hoped to increase the sales more and more. Standing in the crowded, chilly basement, surrounded by devotees, press machines, and transcendental literature, Prabhupada described how he wanted ISKCON Press to operate. He said that after dictating a tape, he would mail it to Boston to be transcribed. Because Prabhupada spoke in English, so it needed to be transcribed. The transcription should take no more than 2 days. During the next 2 days, someone would edit the transcribed manuscript. Then another editor would take 2 days to edit the transcript a second time. Then a Sanskrit editor would add diacritical markings and the manuscript would be ready for composing. So Prabhupada said, Shishi Radha Gopinath ki jam, Shishi Chana Baladev Subhadram ki, Shishi Gornitai ki. Prabhupada said he could produce 15 tapes, 300 manuscript pages every month. At that rate, ISKCON Press should produce a book every 2 months, or 6 books in a year. Prabhupada wanted to print at least 60 books. Therefore, his press workers would have plenty to do for the next 10 years. If the devotees simply printed his books incessantly, he said, even if they had to work 24 hours a day in shifts, it would give him great delight. He was ready, if necessary, to drop all his activities, except for publishing books. This was the special nectar the press devotees were hankering to hear. Printing books was Prabhupada's heart. It was the thing most dear to him. During Prabhupada's week in Boston, Purushottama continued as secretary and servant out of duty. His difficulties in London had increased. Doubtful and morose, he came before Prabhupada 2 days before their departure. Purushottam speaking, "I had decided to live in London. I just felt like there were different things I wanted to do. But I felt obliged to stay with him because he needed me there. It was my job to at least get him back to the States. I felt that he needed someone to travel with him, and I just felt that I should complete that, have everything in order, so I couldn't say to myself that I had just quit when he needed me like that in a foreign country. I didn't tell anybody, I didn't speak against him or anything, I performed my duties, but in my attitude I let him know I was really getting kind of distance the last few days. I didn't bow down to him. I would come in, but I just wouldn't bow down to him. Purushottama entered Prabhupada's room. He didn't bow down, he stood. He was too uncomfortable to sit. Because of the gravity of what he would say, Prabhupada looked up from his desk. "Yes, Purushottama?" First time speaking. "I went in to see him. I knew I was going to leave, and it kind of made me sick to do it. Anyway, I told him, I have a lot of questions about the movement, the moon, and everything. I just don't believe all of this." He was very congenial about the whole thing. He took it nicely. He said to me, this is Purushottama speaking about Prabhupada's reaction. He said to me, meaning Srila Prabhupada said, "If you have questions, why don't you ask me?" And I said, Purushottama said, "You yourself have said that we should only ask questions to somebody we feel we can believe or trust." He looked very hurt. He knew what I was saying. I felt like I really hurt him. I didn't mean it to be so defiant, but there I was. Purushottama said, I think this is Prabhupada said. Yeah, Prabhupada said, "I've noticed that you haven't been well lately. You have had some problems?" And Purushottama said, "Well, I haven't been trying to hide it. I guess I was trying to prepare him for what was coming. I wanted to leave that night. So I said, I want to leave. But he said to me, 'You have been with me so long, and now you are so anxious to go? You can't even stay a night?' He said, 'Why don't you stay at least till my plane leaves?' That was 2 days later. I said, 'Okay, I will do that then.'" Purushottama continues, "I was going to go back to New York. Actually, I didn't have the money for the ticket. And he gave me the money. He gave me the bus fare. I really appreciated that. I could have borrowed some money from someone else, but he said, 'Well, you take it, and you can pay me back later.' And I did. I gave it back the next week. He was very gracious about the whole thing. Actually, I could see that he had a very special, loving way of looking at the world. I felt that sometimes I could see things in a loving way, like he did. And I realized that I got that viewpoint from him. You know, that little loving spirit? He had that. And I kind of caught some of that from him. And that's one of the things I always remember about him. And I know that through his movement, I came to believe in God. Before I met him, I didn't believe in God." After Purushottama left, Prabhupada spoke with Bhavananda about Purushottama's doubts concerning the moon landing and his consequent doubts of Krishna consciousness. I can understand that he might not accept it because I said it, but how could he disbelieve the Vedic Shastras? So we'll read a little more, one more part. Boston's weather was miserable. When the rain stopped, the snow fell, and when the snow stopped, the rain came again. Prabhupada tried taking a way in the front yard. Bhavananda besides him went with an umbrella, watching cautiously to guard him from falling on the ice. But after a week of Boston's nasty December weather, Prabhupada's cold was getting worse. He would go to Los Angeles. On the auspicious occasion of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's appearance day, 25th February, the Los Angeles devotees received permission to enter their new temple on Watsaka Avenue. The rooms had not even been cleaned, and the large hall was bare, but the devotees brought in Prabhupada's Vyasasa from the old temple on La Cienega. And Prabhupada had them place it on a large picture of his spiritual master. Standing before his spiritual master, Prabhupada offered arti while some 50 disciples gathered around him, chanting Hare Krishna and dancing in the otherwise empty hall. After the arti, I think this is the temple where the temple is still today in Los Angeles. It was at that time that Prabhupada has his quarters there, and it's an important temple in the United States. After the arti, Prabhupada directed his disciples in offering flowers to the picture of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. Then, still standing before the Vyasasan, he said he had nothing to offer his spiritual master on this day except his own disciples. He then read aloud the names of all his disciples. Taking his seat on a low Vyasasan besides the large Vyasasan of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, Prabhupada gave a short history of his Guru Maharaj, son of Bhaktivinoda Thakur and powerful Acharya of the mission of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. As Prabhupada recalled his first meeting with the spiritual master, he told how Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati had told him to teach Krishna consciousness to the English-speaking world. This large new temple, Prabhupada said, had been provided by Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati as a gift for the devotees to use in Krishna's service. They should not become attached to the opulence, Prabhupada said, but they should use this wonderful place for preaching. As he spoke, he wept. Now bring them prasadam, Prabhupada called, and the feast began. While devotees sat on the floor in rows, Prabhupada from his Vyasasan directed the servants, having them bring another samosa to one devotee, more chutney to another, and so on. He watched over all of them, encouraging them to take Krishna's prasadam. That afternoon, Prabhupada toured the buildings, in addition to the main hall, which he would have the devotees convert into a temple. He saw the equally large lecture hall. These rooms plus a three-room apartment, ample separate quarters for male and female devotees, a parking lot, and a front lawn, made this the finest physical facility in all of ISKCON. Even today they have bought many apartments and houses around. So it's one of the biggest places in the United States. We don't require such a nice place for our cellars, Prabhupada told the temple president Gargamuni. We are prepared to live anywhere, but such a nice place will give us opportunity to invite gentlemen to come and learn about this Krishna consciousness. The cost of the building had been $225,000 with a $50,000 down payment. Prabhupada had more than $10,000 in his book fund, but that was exclusively for printing books. So although he usually didn't like to deal personally in such negotiations, he had made an exception in this case and had asked the other temples to donate to the new world headquarters in Los Angeles. He had even mailed snapshots of the buildings to various temple presidents around the world. Thus he had collected the down payment, and on Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati's appearance day, ISKCON became the legal owner. This was the only temple ISKCON actually owned. All the other buildings were leased or rented, and Prabhupada wanted to design everything himself. Hiring professionals would be too expensive, but Prabhupada had plenty of disciples eager to do the renovation. Karamdara knew a little carpentry, plumbing and general construction, and he could learn more by experience. Bhavananda had been a professional designer, and he was filled with Prabhupada's enthusiasm to transform the plain church into a dazzling palace for the Supreme Personality of Godhead. "First you make my apartment," Prabhupada told Bhavananda. "Let me move in, and then we will work on the temple room." Bhavananda speaking. "We picked out a part of the Los Angeles temple for Prabhupada's quarters, and Karamdara built the bathroom. When Prabhupada came up to the rooms, he said, 'This will be my sitting room, this will be my bedroom.' And when he came to a third room with a skylight, he said, 'This will be my library.' Prabhupada told me once in Boston that as a child, he lived in a palace with blue walls, red marble floors, and orange and gold trim, the Mulluk's house in Calcutta. So we painted the walls of his sitting room blue, and I put in a white tile floor. The drapes were burnt orange satin with gold cords and gold fringe. Prabhupada liked this color scheme very much." So we'll stop here. And, so Prabhupada ki jha. Shishri Radha Gopinath ki jha. Shishri Jagannath Baladev Subhadra Maharani ki jha. Shishri Gornitai ki jha. Radha this open doors days ki jha.